Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
I am loving this discussion. You guys are kicking some tail here, and this is one of those that I'm going to listen to a bunch of times, and I'm feeling that a lot of our listeners will as well. Phil, was there anything more that you wanted? You talked about, you know, you're smarter when you're grateful because you're able to see more things. You know, you talked about love being, you know, this active virtue, and I loved your getting up Monday morning stuff, Carlisle. Do we want to, like, take where we're at right now and go back into the faith crisis mode and this decision to move into belief or unbelief? So
I was going to say that's where I'd like to go. I'd like to go back and have Phil work with his psychology of disbelief and maybe relate where he was going with that to some of these firecrackers I'm throwing into the next year.
Yeah, well, if I understand the structure of where we're at in our three-way conversation, or maybe it's just that my mind is foregrounding it because of my current preoccupations, then I'm saying, if I'm hearing you right, Carlisle, you're saying that if I'm Fred Johnson and I'm sitting there in church being discontent, I'm not being led into a sense of dignity and increased freedom and enjoyment and compassion and clarity, that one way I can go is to question the institution that has me trapped here doing things that aren't leading me there. Or you're provoking me to the thought that I might think of readdressing that question. I could address it to the church because we're the church and we should be having this conversation, but I also might address it to myself and to God and say, what is it that I need to do to relate to the dimensions of the church in ways that do bring the fruits that it's supposed to bring, if you're right that it's supposed to bring autonomy and dignity and compassion. So I think that, and Dan's restated this too, if I'm understanding you, Dan, that we're at the spot of saying if we redirect those questions to self and to God as well as to the church rather than prematurely concluding it just must...
It's the church, just, yeah.
Yeah, it must be the church. To whom do we ask our most important questions?
Yeah, now we need to be conscious here, and obviously, you know, there's no victim blaming here, you know, the church, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say here is the church has set things up in such a way that these are not the natural ways we go. We tend to start, you know, being down on ourselves. The formula isn't working for me. There must be something wrong with me. And what you're suggesting, I think there, Phil, is we make the conscious decision. We hold enough gumption within ourselves to say, you know, I recognize these forces. I recognize that there's something going on here. And I know I'm not at fault at this moment, but yet I still have a feeling that God, you can teach me more. You can add a new perspective for me and pull me out of this pure negative spiral of dart throwing at the institution that maybe leads to unbelief. Is that at all workable?
Yes, I don't think we as a church and how we've set up correlation and manuals that suffocate authentic discussion, etc. I wouldn't have any problem having a conversation like that. My assumed audience here when I started this psychology of unbelief track about which I'm writing and thinking is not to blame the victim, but my assumed audience is if a person wants to have a relationship with the church, if they don't, far be it from me to try to have a verbal battle with them and try to convince them of something they're not inclined for. But if they're feeling broken or betrayed or wondering what the heck happened or is this true, authentic, and good in Carlyle's senses of these terms, firecrackers, as he calls them, then how might a person go about that and think differently?
Yes.
How would we characterize this person we're referring to who tends to not find the church satisfying institutionally or otherwise?
To me, they're right on the precipice of an important moment in their life. I mean, I would naturally think that this should happen as a result of a normal life progression. You would get to these points where you have to look at the exact questions that we're posing today.
Yeah, but if they don't get beyond that, what's going on? I mean, there's some folks who arrive at that, and it isn't just a way station, but they kind of hang around the periphery of the church and stick a toe in now and again, and oh, still isn't working. So,
I see.
So what is? Is it theology? Is it interpersonal stuff? Is it pride? Which maybe would get close to blaming the victim, which I don't want to do. Is it the failure of our way of teaching in the church? The recycling of manuals year after year after year after year? What's the problem?
Well, I think we could categorize some of the problems and explore them about the structure of how we're going about things, such as recycling manuals and a culture of instruction that asks rhetorical rather than authentic questions, which prompts Sunday school discussions or elders' quorum, relief society discussions that are socially scripted rather than doing authentic, faithful inquiry, so we could talk about us as a group. But with all due respect to blaming the victims, there are such things because I've participated in them myself, so I'm a victim of me. There are such things as selfishness or unimaginative thinking or boredom that isn't merely the church's fault or our manual's fault. I haven't been bored since the 1970s when I went to graduate school, because if I'm ever tempted to be bored, I recognize the boringness is in me. So often, even a boring class is a fascinating thing to observe the dynamics. So there are such things as individual problems that I participate in, whether my name is Sally Fredericks or Philip Barlow. So we don't want to blame the victim exactly, but we are also perpetrators.
Indeed. I would agree. But I just wanted to look inside of that skull of this bright young man who is pursuing with passion different aspects of his life, his profession, and so on. And he's been deeply engaged with the church, went on a mission, so did all of that, but has hit this period of time when it isn't working for him anymore. And I think a lot of the people who come to groups like the one that you and I attended some time ago, Dan, and had a little discussion with, these are good folks. And I think they're genuinely hoping that they can get back and find something that's deeply, that feeds them in the church. And I think they're being authentic and genuine and careful when they make their complaints, when they hold up the flag and say, I can't find it here anymore. So you got to do better. And I guess part of my point is that, again, our lazy tendency to settle for abstractions. So, you know, if I come back to this young man I've just described and say, I would like very much for him to come back and fully engage the church and find in it deep fulfillment. Well, what does that mean? For me, it means, among other things, this short list of components. So what's happening now in his church experience, which may not just not be feeding that, but working against the grain of it? It could be ideas. It could, again, be interpersonal stuff. It could be a number of things. But I think that even if, as an institution, as we try to do better, as a parent, as I try to do better, as a teacher, as I try to do better, what does better mean? That is, what am I trying to produce in life, in the lives of people that I try to reach out to? So I want to help them. What does help them mean? Well, I want them to have life in its fullness.
Yeah. Oh, I do too.
Well, one of the things that would belong on my list as essential to the abundant life is community based on authentic, generous, loving, all of those words need definitions, of course, relationships.
Thank you.
I argue that Joseph Smith's bequest to us is all about transcending fissures and fractures and disjunctions with concepts of friendship and binding and sealing across generations, across genders, across races and nations and history concepts. It's all about enduring and the aspiration towards healthy, loving, growing relations as we participate in God's alleged purposes.
Wow, that's great. Can I jump in with maybe something here, guys? This is a hard thing for me to say, but one of the things I guess I want to say is both of you guys are, I think, saying, you know, Phil, in your case, you're using the term love, you're using the word gratitude and things like this. Carlisle, you're talking about there's a depth to human experience and our spirits need these things. And so I think you're both saying that not choosing, not moving so fast to unbelief and looking at things that are operating, let's say, at, you know, two or three levels less deep. You know what I mean? Beliefs are kind of the easy things to kind of talk about. Or, you know, this action or this practice. We want to go deeper. And I think you're both saying that there's a deep strength that comes, or it's a move of a strong person to now say, let me engage myself again here and see what parts of this are me. And again, we're not blaming any victims here. So let me put this forth, and it's hard to say it out loud because I'll just say what's happened to me and how I think it happened, because I do have that good Monday morning experience that you're talking about, Carlisle, and I have it within the Mormon universe. I mean, I have it with my ward members who are my neighbors and my golf partners and various things. I have it, you know, as I prepare for Sunday, I look forward to seeing them. I do this for a living. I do this podcast, and I'm working on books and things, and I do this for a living. So I do wake up in my Mormonism with the kinds of, you know, sense of personal dignity and autonomy and all the different things that you put there, Carlisle. But how I got there
you go.
Was, and this is where, Phil, this is matches up with what we were talking about yesterday when I came up and spoke to your group in Logan. How I got there was just simply remembering that my mind is only a part of me, that I have this deep rich experience. And so when I defend religion just on general terms, I'm always just like, guys, you know, if weren't for religion, where is the place that at least reminds us to think about the possibility that we might have a spirit? That there might be this eternal, you know, eternal, infinite, you know, aspect to us, this broad belonging to the universe. You know, religion at least lets you play in that arena where secular stuff doesn't, you know? And so for me, it was just, you know, learning what my mind could do and saying, you know, that's just not enough. And so therefore, I decided to re-engage my spirit. I had great mentors that kind of showed me a life of active mind and spirit together. And I just began having these experiences. So now what happens for me when I engage the church, and here's where I think the move that people are afraid of is, like, somehow or other these spiritual experiences kind of warm the rest, so I don't feel like all the critiques that I see, I still see them, but I see them with more forgiving eyes. I see them with, you know, with through the eyes of grace a little bit more. It doesn't mean I don't want to change the wrong ones, but somehow or other, I'm just not in battle every second like, this has to be changed right this second, and it has to, you know, it has to be broad scale and stuff like that, and I'm content to do it one-on-one, or, you know, obviously this microphone that I have here with this podcast is more than just one-on-one, but I'm able to kind of do it, but it was because my spirit was warmed first. And so I'm almost wanting to say, and you guys can tell me whether this is just too abstract, Carlisle, concentrate on your spirit. It's not like you're going to betray your mind. You're just adding that extra thing that Phil was kind of talking about, you know, attitudes and love and things have epistemic qualities to them, and let those things rise up for a little bit and see what happens on the other end. See what happens on that rational end, that end that says, I want to move to unbelief. That was a long one, so react, please, however you guys want to.
When you concentrate on your spirit, Dan, how does that work? What's the focus? What are you concentrating on?
Well, certainly, again, you know, because of my theology background, I love all the teachings, the expansive teachings that you do too, Carlisle. I've seen those in your writings and things like that. So I do that, but it's mostly practice. It's mostly spending time in the morning with. I do kind of a contemplative prayer, meditation, quiet time. You know, I try to read something worthwhile every day, and then as much as I can quiet myself, so that even if the experience of light and love doesn't feel exactly more intense there, I do notice a backlighting or a depth and a richness and a significance to life that just simply naturally is part of my day now. You know, that it wasn't when I was totally just, you know, in these questions and was just so much in my head.
And I appreciate your answering the question.
Phil, is that weird, or have you recognized that with people? Like, oh, well, if I cut some, it looks like you're just cutting the church too much slack, where I'm trying to say, you know, I didn't do that on purpose. It just sort of naturally came as a flowering, you know, of, you know, not wanting to, you know, another being more patient with it, but yet still, you know, I'm fighting for it. I'm having this podcast. You know, I'm fighting for betterness. But yet at the same time, I'm less triggered, you know, negatively.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a very healthy place to be to me. Love is long-suffering, patient, hopeful, and that goes towards the church and others. And we need to keep conversations that is the premise of our discussion here tonight. How might we do better? And when things are not being nourishing, how might we as a church, or I as an individual, or we as friends to the posited young people we're talking about, or older people? So faithful inquiry and faithful urging for growth among us need not take the form of vehement cynicism and anger, but passivity as opposed to pacifism is not inevitably a wonderful virtue or growth mode.
Right. So we can be critical, of course, without being resentful, without being hostile, without being hateful. We can be critical and open and genuine in a sense that this is wonderful that we have, but there are a lot of folks we're leaving on the periphery, and we're just trying to figure out whys and wherefores and what it is that we can do better by way of reaching out to them. So I love what you said, Dan, about your own journey. I think it was beautifully put.
Well, and I guess I'm just trying to emphasize again, it doesn't in my heart, it doesn't inside me feel like I'm selling out my intellect, you know? Whereas I think so much of this, move to unbelief is an intellectually driven thing. And somehow or other, by at least entertaining the possibility that I had a spirit and seeing these mentors of mine who definitely somehow to me did both mind and spirit, and then starting those practices again, you know, I guess towards, you know, it's hard to say start a practice when you're in the middle of the worst part, you know, of your thing. So somehow or other, you know, I probably found it a fairly decent cycle when I began, you know, to have some optimism at all. And then I did the practices, but then, you know, once I began to just give my spirit room to grow, I naturally saw more in our theology. I naturally saw more room for me to act authentically within the church, etc. And I wasn't selling out my brain.
Well, but I'm interested in a lot of, in your word, practices. And if I understand you, some of those practices, or many of them, you could clarify for me, aren't conducted in the context of your institutional experience.
No,
they are rather practices that you have come to in your personal spiritual life, and now can augment your approach to your version of Mormonism and so on. Do I get that right?
Yeah, or they just create energy and light and optimism in me that then naturally helps me engage the rest.
Well, that's that secure base I'm talking about, and so a secure base from which I can love people, or a secure base from which I can be more measured in the way I relate to the institution or the aspects of it that may not fully satisfy me, but it's that secure base. And how you found your way to it, and I think that mindfulness in the research that I've been doing into that field and trying to share it with folks has very much to say about what I think your experience has been, Dan.
Yeah, I think so too.
Carlisle, let me pose a question as I'm thinking about and liking the secure base that you're talking about and that I talked about in response to a question you posed. But I would want to test my ideas and my notions of your ideas and yours, Dan, on this security thing to make sure that I'm secure in what I'm understanding so far. So one of the most famous passages in American literature and one of my favorites in Huckleberry Finn is, as you'll remember, when Huck and his runaway friend, the slave Jim, are floating down the river and they're pursued by slave catchers, and everything about Tom or Huck's upbringing has taught him to disobey the law is a sure way to hell, and to aid and abet Jim is going to be against the law. And so he's really torn inside about his inchoate love for Jim and obeying his aunt Molly or whatever her name was. So finally he decides in a crisis, all right, then I'll go to hell. And so he doesn't turn Jim in and protects him. So it seems like he's in a Mormon version of an Adam and Eve existential crisis with contradictory commandments going on, and he has to choose one. And by our perspective, he chooses the higher way, would we say he's well grounded in your sense of that meaning?
Well, I think his very struggle in that wonderful passage indicates that one foot in, one foot out, but at least he's had enough of what I think we're trying to talk about.
Yeah,
that he ventures, that he takes the step, and then finds out that, yes, indeed, I think I understand now. But I think that wonderful passage is giving us an insight into the struggle. How do we move? The day one out of the womb, we're sucking in the stuff that he was fighting against without knowing what he was fighting against. So he was struggling in that beautifully written scene, but he made it. He pulled it off. And I guess my thought would be, after he did that once, oh, then I'm closer to home. Now I get it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, yeah, and step by step, your spirit kind of awakens, and you realize that there's a richness there, and that conflict isn't to always be avoided. That there's, you know, when you can feel those pulls within you, and not be afraid by them. You know, when you can kind of step into them, that's when you move to that next level where you discover it, that this is perfectly fine. And now I'm ready for more adventures in spirit.
Yeah, you do discover it experientially, ultimately, if you discover it. So,
yeah. Right.
Well, you do discover it, and you are not keen on abstract theology. Lowell Binion used to say abstract theology saves no one, so I understand the problem. But it does seem to me that the example I just gave of Adam and Eve in the whole history, Judaism and Christianity, Mormonism is the only one who takes the mythic dimensions of that story, although it doesn't always know it's taking the mythic dimensions of that story, to get an existential situation that humans, as you've just said, I think, have to encounter intrinsically and inevitably will encounter, but also have to encounter it if they're going to find what it means to be well-grounded, or even forge, help participate in their well-groundedness. They have to encounter moral ambiguity and conflict and choose out of that matrix.
Yeah. So here we have a story that can help us there, even if we realize it's mythic. It names something.
Yeah, it is. It's a story, and it has mythic dimensions, but it's also theological and as abstract or not abstract as you like it. But it seems to me that theology, story, scripture, and experience meet at one point.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And then I think we said it earlier, I think both Carla and I said it earlier, as you have the experience, as you have the richness, you then see it in the theology. You know, those parts that were, you know, who has eyes to see, you know, sees, who has ears to hear, hears. As your spirit's kind of vibrating at this level, you just discover that, wow, there's a lot of scripture that vibrates at that level. And, you know, the story that meant one thing to you when you're a child now means completely something different to you with these new eyes. And so that's, to me, the connection. But, you know, you're not going to see the richness of the theology, I think, unless you're somehow feeding and growing in the other half. It can entertain you. And I remember early on in my graduate school's years, it was just sort of fun to throw Mormon ideas at my classmates and for have them scratch their head and say, wow, that's an interesting angle. I didn't know Mormons had any interesting angles. And it was more of an intellectual exercise, you know. But I hadn't lived into it because I was still questioning things. But I knew that Mormonism had, you know, this approach to the mind-body problem, or, you know, the problem of evil or something like that. And I was playing with it at that level. So I did see that there was richness there in the sense of, hey, it brings a new element to discuss. But now it's more like I feel like that there was spirit behind, you know, those gists that Joseph Smith sort of put out there. I understood that he was saying those things, but now I could sort of see that he was vibrating at a pretty rich level, you know.
So, could I lob one other firecracker for just a moment? Do we have time?
You bet.
Can't you ever be gentle with us, Carla?
Yeah, your grenades, firecrackers.
Anyway, someone said something like the ultimate frustration is to be in direct pursuit of that which, by its nature, must be allowed to ensue, to come as a byproduct.
Nice.
So I'm thinking about our tendency to pursue even spiritual enlightenment by direct means, to pursue happiness by direct means. We all understand this kind of an issue, but it occurs to me that what we're really talking about is that the ultimate stage of human fulfillment is when I ain't trying anymore, is self-transcendence. And with that in mind, I'm convinced, and I made reference to this a few minutes ago, that conventional religion makes self-transcendence all but impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are the seeds, just the seeds, in Mormon theology of truths that can invite us finally to be over the business of fixing myself. And I'm totally now turned outward, engaged with creating for the sake of creating, with learning for the sake of learning, with nurturing for the sake of nurturing, and I'm gone. So there's this interesting paradox. Religion can be the most powerful turned inwardness force in our lives, when in fact, paradox being what Christ said to us is, you got to lose it to find it. And so what is there, again, in Mormon theology that we can develop and bring to more complete visibility that would help us take this last step where, and I frankly, I don't know, I think I've had touches of it, but I admit, confess, only touches, but it's quite wonderful. I'm gone. All that's on the scene is what I'm doing for the sake of what I'm doing. And again, I make this claim. Conventional religious notions, ideas, and motivation make all but impossible my arriving at that point.
Mm-hmm. There's a tension there in various religious traditions, like Buddhist traditions will widely talk about no self and the extinction of self, although they fight about how to cast the right word, because extinct
right. Is
like a negative connotation, but the letting go of self, and so that's all important. But there are strands or tensions of disagreement among the Buddhist thinkers over time between the concept of no self versus no solo self, or no self that's not a part of all the other selves or something. And so the language can get tricky. Or this concept of love, again, is paradoxical. If it's a matter of reaching out for the well-being and spiritual growth of others, it's ironic or paradoxical in that the reaching out is an effortful thing and it intrinsically makes you a stronger self. But if you're doing the reaching just to make a bigger, stronger self, fix yourself, then it seems to backfire and dissolve or explode or something in the way that you're suggesting. So it is a little paradoxical, but I largely amen to what you just said.
The no-self that I would be talking about is really based on the sovereign self. I mean, I'm back to yapping about this sense of security. And for me, it is, however you define it or what label you give to it, it's not a no-self, but it's finally this sovereign self is that secure foundation which enables me now to truly reach out, with the emphasis on out. Very often when we're reaching out, we're really reaching in. We're trying to have an experience here. And all of that is gone in these highest points of human experience, seems to me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Carla, I will link to your dialogue essay about Is There Life Before Death, that where you talk about the sovereign self in greater detail. So I appreciate you reminding me of that that concept. That's terrific. Now, my answer to you, or at least where I was going to go on your question about what did you call it, standard religion or
conventional
religion? Yeah, does it make it impossible or something? This is where my James Fowler kind of natural human development thinks. I think religion does great in bringing us up to a secure worldview. Generally, helps with moral development and kind of a sense. And I think at those childhood levels and young adult levels and early adult levels, we do have spiritual experiences and we get some taste of genuine and authentic spirit. And so I think conventional religion does a good job of kind of bringing you up to that level. Where it then makes it hard is when it says this is all there is, and it doesn't encourage the adult level dives. And because those adult level dives include taking apart the story, beginning to see it more mythically, beginning to feel the energies that are at play within our hearts and our minds, and it can lead us to these kinds of difficulties that we started the whole discussion today talking about there. But on the other hand, once you push through, Fowler calls it stage 4, and you begin to kind of conjoin in stage 5, the mythic with the earlier views, and the sense of security can kind of return, and then, you can bid into that sovereign self kind of mode within a religion comfortably, but you're basically fighting institutional forces, you're fighting community forces when I want more.
And I'm fighting ideas, too, and particularly back to Joseph's notion that if you're going to be religiously oriented, if you're going to be God-oriented, please be careful about how you're understanding him, his nature.
Right.
You folks are probably familiar with some of the research behind if you take two groups of students and give them a task to engage in and then set them loose, and you've set it up so that the task or the game or whatever is inherently interesting to the point that they really do get involved with it. Then you come on the scene and you pull one group aside and you add something to this group. You add extrinsic payoffs for what they formerly found quite wonderful to engage for the sake of what they were doing. And then they turn both groups loose. Guess what happens? Inevitably, the folks who had the add-on of extrinsic payoffs, their interest, enjoyment, and effectiveness goes down.
Yeah.
So this intrinsic motivation, is that a key component of human fulfillment? I think so.
Yeah.
I think it is. But we easily put God in the role of Saturday night paymaster. And so this is what I mean by this fundamental sense of who he is and how he relates to us and what he wants from us. if he's a suffering, laboring God who requires and begs for our collaboration because he needs it, not because he wants to give us exercises so we can grow, that distinction starts to take on real meaning to me.
Right, for sure. And he and she, the divine couple, however you'd want to expand that, whatever God is.
Sure.
Yeah,
right.
that collaborative God. And if we're eternal, co-eternal elements of the universe as belonging and as capable of enlargement as anything else, all those things add to me to exactly this kind of stuff. And so Mormonism has these elements. It's just hard to remember them sometimes on Sundays and sometimes in the noise of those who...
But I'm not as positive as you are. When you say remember, I think so many of us have never been taught it.
You know, my experience is whenever I share it, though, everyone nods. So I guess
because it tastes good.
Oh, okay, rather than they remember having it been taught.
Yeah,
okay.
I think that if we just put the question this way, are we doing a good job of clarifying and teaching the implications of that which is distinctive in Mormon theology? Are we doing that currently? I'm not convinced.
Yeah, only on the Mormon Matters podcast, not just Easton.
There you go.
No, honestly, it's interesting because this is where my dissertation ended. So I was playing with these distinctive elements. And so for some reason,
right.
The last 20 years of my life have been engaged with these. And I don't generally see a whole lot of clouded over things. But that was a provocative thing by saying it's because they taste good versus the fact that they were taught it before. I think it's going to be a combination of both of both of our positions there. So neat. Phil, I want you to jump in, and can you let's just move towards closure. So, Phil, any thoughts that you either want to link back to earlier things that you want to re-say or jump on where Carlisle and I were and then go to that? Let's just kind of look at this as a Phil wrap-up for tonight.
Well, I have just a couple of related but new in the sense of we haven't stated them thoughts.
Okay, so please.
I could imagine a brother, sister, cousin, bishop, state president, Relief Society president getting nervous about a candid, open conversation like this out there somewhere in the kingdom. And what I would like to stress, or what I was just thinking, is that what we're talking about is how to be faithful better within the parameters of the Mormon gospel. All these things are there. And one principle that I would want to champion and argue that Carlisle's question and thought experiment has profundity to it, but it's also very simple, or my arguing that virtues and character traits affect the lens with which we take in reality and then respond to it, that we create our own realities for good or ill in respects. So these gospel principles, asking a question of what is the abundant life and what's preventing me in my church life or faith life from living it more abundantly, are good essential type questions to ask, and they're Jesus-like questions in the sense that they are simple enough to talk with children about, but profound enough to discuss with philosophers. So I would seek, if somebody, let's say my clone living in Iowa is concerned that we're getting esoteric or we're getting far away from gospel fundamentals, I would argue just the opposite, that we're talking about how to love and what is its consequences, or how to live abundantly and richly and get at the simple, profound fundamentals, basics of the gospel and healthy, fruitful living. But it has to be a disciplined, achieved simplicity. But I do think they're simple gospel fundamentals whose implications can be huge and complex, and that's nice. What we need to tease out, as opposed to somebody worrying that we're championing thickets of speculation and esoterica. That's the opposite of what we're championing.
Nice.
And then a final thought was that I was having there as I listened was that one of the great damning sins that I or we as a people may commit sometimes is the trivialization of the gospel and the routinization of the gospel and gospel living. So I said last night, Dan, when we were with our Logan young single adults, following up on your presentation to them, that when we say, when the Lord says, Scripture says, the prophet says, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, that we often trivialize that or stop at a tiny concept, which is don't say damn it after you've said the name of God or like that. As opposed to we take the Lord's name upon us when we covenant in the sacrament, and do we do that vainly? Do we take the name of the Lord God in vain, which is to say emptily or trivially? Do we trivialize great things by not having a conversation like this, not probing the essence of the gospel? So this is the most boringly, relentlessly orthodox conversation you're ever likely to have. That's my point.
Yes, nice, nice.
So let me just make a comment here before you shut me off, so that I'm not misunderstood by good folks. Nice. I think you two are working with me, but I truly love to the marrow of my bones that which is distinctive in Mormon theology. And so what I've said here that may have a kind of negative ring to it is from a loving critic standpoint.
Right. Nice.
And I see so many out there suffering in ways that could be mitigated. The kind of suffering, in other words, that they're experiencing, could be mitigated by their full bore engagement with the gospel, with life at its highest pitch, and what is available in the gospel and the church to enable them to come to that. I don't know, you know, where else are you going to find it? I work with mindfulness. It's wonderful, but it all relates. It all relates to some basic truths about who we are and what life is and what it can be. And I don't know a better single package to make that real than that which is distinctive in Mormon theology.
That's how you're coming across to these ears, brother.
Yeah, yeah. And distinctive to me and wider Christianity too. I just had a wonderful podcast with Adam Miller and Joe Spencer, and you can't believe how wonderful the discussion was on grace and Paul's theology of grace and sort of, you know, when you start and you foreground grace versus foregrounding sin as the problem, you know, I agree with you. There's just richness. I agree with you in the distinctiveness of Mormonism, but there's a lot of richness in just fundamental Christian stuff. Even just, you know, for God so loved the world. I mean, right there, you know, I'll go, oh, holy night on you, and just say, the soul felt its worth. You know, all those things come to me, you know, as just these initial experiential, existential, I now have a new feeling about myself stuff. And when you get that, I think lots of religions can bring us there. But Mormonism certainly can. Wider Christianity certainly can. And I have to grant that I've seen folks, you know, transformed from other traditions that aren't even theistic ones. So somehow or other, those to me are the initial moves. And then I'm with you. Then when Mormon theology starts getting big and brave and bold, and it tastes good and all that stuff to me, Carlisle, I'm exactly where you're at.
Kind of gets the blood flowing, doesn't it?
It's a great religion. But again, and I guess I'm just, for me, it became even a greater religion. At first, it was intellectually because, like I said, it gave me things to talk about and think about that were fun angles. But it became a much, much greater religion as I found my spirit awakening along with my brain.
Yep.
When both things came together, the Mormonism became bigger and a much more comfortable home for me. So, did you have any other final thoughts, Carlisle?
Nope, but just to say I've really enjoyed it. And Phil, thank you.
So glad I got the two of you together.
Good to be in conversation, my brothers.
Thank you, brothers, and I will encourage listeners to look at the links that I will put as part of the write-up for this on the blog site, read some things from both these good gentlemen, and just continue the discussion there and in Facebook and all these other places. I really think we hit on some rich, rich material, and I'm so grateful. While you're at the website, please click on the donate button or start a new subscription to Mormon Matters. Your donations are absolutely godsends and what really allow this kind of stuff to happen. So I'm just so grateful to all your support in that way. I'll just wish both of you a wonderful good night.
Thanks, Dan. Same to you.
Thanks for the hour. Good night.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.